Sometimes my recognition software triggers a message. We found one. The brain then shoots waves of endorphins and energy and words to nudge me toward investigation. This was one of those moments. Diego explained the finer things of coffee to us for an hour, then invited us to his roasting headquarters down the street. He made a phone call, and a pretty young barista showed up to relieve him of duty so that he could spend more time with us. Over the next few days, we spent a lot of time with Diego. It was obvious that he enjoyed shaping our view of Mexico City. He would bring us to a new bar, a restaurant, an art installation, and watch us absorb it all. He was tasting his city through the eyes of a newcomer, seeing it fresh again, glowing with an ambassador's pride. He took us to a wild and huge market, full of fruits we had never seen, and fish and pigs split down the middle and displayed. The smell of ripe fruit, flowers, raw meat, spices, mushrooms, it was almost too much to handle. The smells combined to make a new aroma, unrecognizable to the brain, alien. He took us to the National Museum of Anthropology, a giant building too big for one visit, overflowing with the most important artifacts of the Maya, Aztecs, and all the native peoples of Mesoamerica. I stumbled through the halls, slack-jawed, gawking at statues and bones, trying to read the descriptions for every stone head, every hieroglyph, every carved column. At the center of the museum's capacious main entry hall, we came upon a stone circle 12 feet across and intricately carved. It was lit up and wanted to be noticed. In the middle was a face, and then carved scenes radiating out. I knew it immediately. The Mayan calendar, I whispered to myself. I had seen it printed on countless Mexican shirts and flags and painted on walls. There it was, the real one. I walked up to it as if possessed by it and went straight to the plaque. No, it isn't a Mayan calendar. It isn't even Mayan. It's Aztec. That is a common mistake, it said. It's also not exactly a calendar. Anthropologists disagree, but modern scholars now believe it was a battle floor, a ritualistic altar for gladiator sacrifices. It does seem to depict different eras, and it has the sun god in its center, so its proper name is the Sunstone, or the Stone of the Five Eras. It seems to have been carved in the early 1500s and wasn't meant to be displayed upright on a wall as it is now. It was on the ground, like a holy boxing ring, where warriors would wrestle or fight to the death, or it was an altar for sacrifices. I stood there, imagining their blood flowing through the carved stone images as they died. Pre-Columbian cultures have always been a keen interest of mine, the complexities of their cities and customs all developing in the absence of the arch, the wheel, and for the most part, written language. The stories of their doomed resistance to European conquest and disease. Their religions, their kings, their sacrifices. How the Spanish tricked them, wowed them with firepower, won their trust only to lie and steal from them. So rabid were those Christian warriors for gold and power. How the contagion of greed mixed with evangelism led Spain and Portugal to take over a landmass much larger than Europe, toppling empires that had been thousands of years in the making, all the while congratulating themselves for civilizing the savages. As I walked through the museum, a familiar sense of guilt set in. My white skin, my European heritage. Europe had gotten rich off stolen gold, stolen labor, stolen land. The United States prides itself in being this great democratic experiment, a modern representative democracy of 300 million inhabitants that has a low corruption rate and the largest economy in the world. I love my country. I love reading the words of the founding fathers, the thoughts they tested while trying to build a nation on virtue, wisdom, and fairness. But the wealth, beauty, and privilege of the West parades on top of the bones of the defeated. Mexicans tell their story in a different way than we do in the United States. They show patriotism, but less confidence. They cannot cover up what happened to their indigenous people. There were too many of them. Their native cultures were too large to erase or silence. In modern Mexico, and through most of Latin America, both the original cultures and the conquests of imperial Catholicism are still everywhere apparent. Maybe that's why I sensed in Mexico that people see their past more soberly. They seemed to hold pride and shame in the same hand. Perhaps a Mexican can see the United States more clearly than we can, too. Maybe our neighbors can view our imperialism around the world, our blood-stained hands, with more understanding than I ever did as a kid. I was told that America won wars, besides the Vietnam War, and led the world in freedom and democracy, and gave its people the best lives possible. I never questioned that until I traveled. Mexico City is full of the ghosts of a brutal past, of dead Mayan kings, Aztec kings, and the mystery pyramids of a time before the Aztecs, a mystery to them and a mystery to us. The footprints of these people, the tumultuous centuries, exist freshly, more like Europe, I would guess. But for me, markedly different than in the United States. You can feel it in Mexico City all around you, in the cathedrals built by captured slaves, built to demand worship by the sword, built to ensure every last drop of gold made it back to Spain. The giant complex city had seduced me. All it took was a couple good new friends as guides and the surprise that comes from a place exceeding expectations, lazy biases, and half-thought thoughts. I'm sure my mom had said at some point, "Mexico City is the most dangerous city in the world." Maybe so, but I hadn't seen that. I saw incredible coffee and stylish people and the best museum ever. Mexico City was my dirty juggernaut of charm and creative energy. The newness and surprise of the city messed with my sense of time. I was tasting the street food and learning the history and gawking at the architecture, and time was slow and fast. Days flew by, but I felt like I'd been there for months. I was living in a vortex, an autonomous moment. After a glorious week exploring the city, we had Thanksgiving with Diego and told stories of how it's done in the States. We FaceTimed our families. I spoke to my mom, and then my dad. Weston spoke to his mom, and not his dad. I missed my family and missed the feeling of an American holiday. I thought about missing Christmas. Being on a beach in southern Mexico or El Salvador for Christmas was beautiful and romantic, but somehow it sounded so unappealing. I began to think about a visit home to catch my breath. We spent one more week in Mexico City. We weren't ready to leave it just yet. Weston sat at cafes and swiped his way through Tinder. He wanted to find a beautiful Latin girl, here and there, to have a romp with. But as he swiped over and over, and chatted with girls and more girls, he discovered that this was harder than he thought it would be. A friend had told him to match as many as he could, swipe right on all of them, and then sort through the matches. He included in his profile that he was just passing through, cycling to Patagonia, to make clear that he wasn't looking for a relationship. He just wanted to have fun. Unfortunately for his libido, women didn't find much appeal in that. He'd chat with a lady and make himself crystal clear, and they'd stop chatting back. "I'm finally a guy who's honest and not playing games, and they want none of it," he said. Weston wanted me to cut loose and be freer, too. He kept asking me if I wanted to go to a gay bar. "We're in a big city now. There's got to be tons of gay guys here. Don't you want to kiss someone? Get a little drunk and have fun?" I wished I could be so free. I wished I could be flippant, but I couldn't. He convinced me to download Tinder on my phone. I swiped through some cute boys, but couldn't take it seriously. I mostly laughed and showed him profiles that amused me. Guys without shirts, lying in their beds in only underwear, pushing their butts out in unnatural ways, or grabbing a bulge, wearing sunglasses, in bed. I kept thinking about the last conversation I had with my mom about my sexuality. I could hear her in my ear. It was 2 years ago, on the phone. She had called me after finding out that I'd started a gay Bible study group. I was living in San Diego and stepping closer to accepting myself. A major reason I hadn't kissed a boy, or tried to date, or even examined the theology around homosexuality was that I had never seen a gay Christian man modeled for me. I didn't know any. And I deduced, if there wasn't one, maybe that's because something about being gay inherently corrupts the relationship with God. But a friend said to me, "Jed, there's always someone that goes first. Maybe God wants you to be that person in your community. Be the godly Christian gay man you wished you'd seen." I was shaken. I'd expected to be told and shown, not commissioned. I started going to a gay-affirming church. I asked them if I could start a Bible study for young gay men, a support group to navigate the oddness of being a paradox, a believer in a religion that didn't believe in us. They said yes. I thought, maybe if I start this, I can finally meet a godly gay man and find love. Maybe we can model a Christ-centered gay relationship. I wrote on Facebook about my decision to start the study. I said I wasn't convinced being gay was against God's plan. I said I was no longer running from my questions, but looking for answers. My mom called me the moment she read it. "Jed, we need to discuss this," she said, her voice controlled and curt. It was different from any voice I'd ever heard her use. "What's wrong, Mom?" "I read what you wrote on Facebook." My face got hot and my heart started pounding. I hadn't even thought about her reading it. Somehow, I thought only my friends would see my post. I forgot my mom would be there, first in line. "It breaks my heart, Jed." "I don't know what to say, Mom. I didn't really mean for you to read that." "The fact that you would say those words, it's very sad, and not you. You just give up? You think you can't overcome that? Sexual sin is one of the darkest sins, because it springs from the deepest part of us." I knew she believed these things, but we'd had years of avoiding the conversation. I'd been such a good Christian boy, never making any overt statements affirming homosexuality. I'd been all over the map, believing it was okay, not believing, flip-flopping back and forth. I guess the fact that I'd never come home with a boyfriend or shown any outward sign that I was still gay let her believe that I'd been in the process of healing, of reprogramming, of getting over my little gay phase. "Mom, it's not like I've walked away from my faith. I'm just being honest with my journey. I love you so much. I just want you to be safe, and I feel like you lean too heavily on your own understanding. You don't seem to respect the word of God. It has survived for thousands of years through civilizations, and you think your one life knows more than it." "I'm not saying that, Mom. I don't want you calling yourself gay. I don't believe that is the truth." "Well, Mom, it's an honest observation. I am not attracted to girls. It was much easier for me to say not attracted to girls than to use the affirmative I am attracted to boys." "Well, I believe you just haven't met the right girl yet. I am praying that a girl comes along and inflames your passions. I know God will provide that. I've been praying about this since you were 2 years old."
"What do you mean, 2 years old?"
"Yes, your father said that he thought you might be gay when you were two. Why on earth would any normal father say such things? It was like he spoke a curse over you. And I prayed to God many times to break the curse that your father spoke over you. It was like he was passing his sexual confusion on to you. He left a wake of sexual pain, adultery, more than you know. I believe that had an impact on your development. I've been praying for years. It makes me so frightened to hear you speak this way, Jed."
"Mom, I don't know what to tell you. I know you love me and want to protect me, but you need to look honestly at the cost of your father's choices. He hurt a lot of people, and he hurt you by not being a right example to you. I've worked for 30 years to forgive him, to process the pain and betrayal. But you haven't. You don't know the effects. You wanting to accept these things is not a sign of strength. It's confusion. Ugh, I just don't see it that way. It is an abomination. It disgusts me. I got quiet. I froze at that word. I had never heard my sweet mother use a word like disgust, much less directed at me. It echoed in my head like a gong. I felt my jaw tighten, and then my fear morphed into anger. Mom, don't say that. Don't talk about things you don't understand. But she didn't miss a beat. I know what God says about it, and what more do I need to know? It is an ambiguous language. I love you dearly, and it is a mother's job to protect her child. I know you're an adult, and I fear every day for you. To see you embrace a lifestyle that leads to disease and death? You will be childless. It is a sad life. I don't want that for you. God doesn't either. What kind of mother would I be if I encourage you to walk down this path? Is that what you want? A mother who doesn't care about her son? Her words were frenzied and strange, as if something exploded from pressure. As if she had stored up thousands of words over decades for this exact conversation. Fearing I might be corrupted by the mainstream media and the ideas of the secular world. Fearing I would rebel. Fearing I would contract AIDS and die like so many gays on TV from the 80s. I'm heartbroken, Jed. The conversation was terrible and trailed off, and I said I needed to go. My thoughts were formless and hot and achy. I hadn't spoken to her about it since then. For 2 years, we just ignored it. I deleted the Tinder app. It didn't feel right. If I was going to be gay, it had to be monumental and honorable and moral. I couldn't meet my almighty Christian husband, the man that would impress everyone and change everyone's minds, on an app. As the second week ended, what had been the wonders of the city settled into the stuff of everyday living. We knew our way around. Beatrice had work and things to do and let us alone. Even Diego had things to do. We started to feel like an imposition. I found myself ready to leave. No less in love with Mexico City, but busy in my head. The Tinder thing had shaken me up a little. Weston was so adamant about me kissing someone, having fun. I didn't want to know I could download Tinder again and look. I didn't want temptation. I wanted the road. My questions about life and God diminished when I was biking into new territory. My purpose became where to camp, where to find food, how to avoid angry dogs, on the collapsing distance between myself and Patagonia. There was no time for other confusions. Part 3, Central America. Chapter 9. What happens if I go home? Oaxaca and Christmas. 10,441 miles to go. Weston and I said goodbyes to Beatrice and Diego. Weston gladly accepted a gift of weed from Diego, and we prepared to head south. Diego had raved about Oaxaca, 280 miles southeast of us, famous for its mezcal and spirituality. Before we left town, I FaceTimed my mom once more. She liked me to talk to her before we headed out into the back roads or camping. She liked to know how hard to pray. She asked me to come home for Christmas to see my family and my new baby niece. She said, "This baby will only have her first Christmas once, and you're gonna miss it?" "Mom, I can't leave the road," I told her. "It's cheating." "Cheating on who? Cheating what?" "I feel like I have to stay on the bike and not leave. It's part of my rite of passage." "Jed, I am 66 years old. When you're my age, things like that don't matter. What matters is time spent with those you love and not missing moments that matter. Don't be stubborn. This is your trip. This is your life. Do what you want." "No one that I've ever heard of has ridden a bicycle clear from Oregon to Mexico City. And you'll go right back down there. Just come home for a couple weeks and hold this baby and see your mama. I've prayed you wouldn't die every day in Mexico, and here you are alive, and I think God owes me the chance to lay eyes on you." I said I'd think about it. We bussed out of town far enough to clear all the chaos of city congestion, then started biking. Soon the terrain was hilly and green, not wild or remote, but easy two-lane streets. I biked for a day and I thought on it. My mom's words rang in my ear. Cheating who? I remembered Andrew Morgan, the fellow whose trip inspired mine, and his words to me. This trip belongs to you, no one else. Don't let anyone dictate your life to you. I walked out the idea in my mind. If I do it, I'll just go and come right back. Maybe Weston will want to do that too. We can ship our bikes or just leave them in Oaxaca and come back for them. It felt good to think about, felt calming and free, felt like I was in control of my trip and my story. On a rest break, I brought it up. Weston, I said, I think I may go home for Christmas. Really? He said. His surprise embarrassed me. He thought a moment. But you'll come back, right? Of course I'll come back. Would you want to go home too? No, I don't have the money, and I wouldn't want to spend it on that anyway. I'm here to be here. I felt like a fake, and maybe I was, but my heart desired to see my family and my baby niece, and even saying it out loud felt good. So good that my embarrassment at Weston's certainty in staying didn't deter me. I had decided. I had only been on the road 3.5 months, but I was going home for Christmas, because I wanted to. Weston and I rode to Oaxaca in less than a week. We surprised ourselves at how quickly we readjusted to biking after such a long break. The road did get more remote, winding, mountainous, but the elevation changes weren't terrible, as we were already high and remained on the plateau. The nights were chilly and the days sharp and sunny. Trees and farms and cows kept us company along the way. We stayed mostly in cheap hotels in the towns that sprinkled the route. We pulled into Oaxaca in the early evening and went straight into a mezcal bar. We got 2 shots and tried the famous drink. It tasted like tequila, but smoky and earthy. The bartender was proud of it and handed it to us over the bar like a magic potion. It's not like other alcohol. Does not make you drunk. No crazy. It makes you awake, alive, he said. We asked him about hostels, and he told us of a good one just a block away. Oaxaca is a famous escape for artists and weirdos, a place with magical energy, close enough to Mexico City to be a weekend getaway, a place for second homes and retreats. Diego had put us on email with a local Oaxacan archaeologist. He had spent decades studying the nearby ruins of Monte Albán, one of the oldest archaeological sites in Mexico. The archaeologist, named Alfonso, responded with a short email. I have an extra room. You are welcome to be my guests. We met him in town the next day, and he offered to take us to his work at the ruins. He was a small, soft-spoken man who wore loose clothes and a khaki bucket hat. We sat in the bed of his truck, and he showed us worn-down pyramids and grass mounds that looked like nothing but were intact, ancient, pre-Columbian homes, temples, and pantries. We stayed with Alfonso for 5 days. His quiet voice and knowledge of the pre-Columbian world made for lovely, gentle conversation on the terrace of his home. The house was modest and modern, with big glass windows and books stacked high along every wall. We had our own room and bathroom, which was nice, especially as Weston found himself unable to keep food down, something he'd eaten, we supposed. When Alfonso said that Oaxaca was famous for mushrooms and shamans and guided experiences, Weston's gray complexion perked up. He began talking to people he met in town, to backpackers with dreads and baggy pants, with bartenders. He was investigating. Finally, falling asleep on Alfonso's futon, side by side as we always were, he told me that he'd found a spot in the mountains that hosted mushroom ceremonies. A place with real magicians, indigenous wisdom, and travelers from all over. He told me he was going to go. Perfect, I said. Why don't you do that, and I'll go home for a few weeks and meet you back here. I think a bunch of homies are doing New Year's in Nicaragua. I may try to get down there by then. Oh, I said. Shit, well, what would I do with my bike? And I'd be missing El Salvador and Guatemala. But truth be told, we were behind schedule, and if I was to track my timeline right, to follow the dry season all the way south and avoid bad weather, to reach Patagonia in the southern hemisphere's summer, I needed to be in Panama by January. That was 2,800 kilometers from Oaxaca, or 1,740 miles. We'd spent too much time in cities and towns and making memories with new friends and waiting out the cartel. But since my purity was already ruined by deciding to go home, I could go home, then jump to Nicaragua, which is what I proposed to Weston. What if I mail my bike to wherever New Year's is going to be, and then we meet there, I said. Fine by me, he said. So I made plans to bus back to Mexico City, mail my bike to Nicaragua, fly to Nashville, then fly to Nicaragua after Christmas. While I was booking flights, Weston organized his spirit quest and terrorized the bathroom with diarrhea. I'll wait for you to leave, then I'll go to the mountain, he said. I don't want you tainting the vibe. What does that mean? I laughed. It's spiritual. You don't like stuff like this. I'm spiritual, I said. Yeah, but you're like churchy. This is witchy. Pagan. You wouldn't like it. And mushrooms make you sensitive to people's energy. You'll fuck it up, he said with a grin. Oh, well, in that case, yeah, I wouldn't want to harsh your mellow. We both chuckled, and I felt good with our choices. The moment I made the decision to go, I felt a weight lift from me. I landed in Nashville with stinging wet eyes and a lump in my throat. My mom picked me up in her shiny Nissan. Not a scratch on you, she said. Prayer works. She leaped from the car and hugged me. Or perhaps Mexico isn't as dangerous as you thought, Mom, I said with a smirk. I was playing it cool. Don't take this away from the Lord, she said. I got in the car and we headed down the interstate at 70 miles per hour. It felt like flying. The roads seemed so freshly paved. I didn't have my bike stored underneath or in the trunk. I felt so light, just my body and a little bag. It was a 20-minute ride from the airport to my mom's house, and I was glued to the window. The houses had no fences, no walled-in courtyards, no security gates. The yards looked manicured and orderly. The Nashville trees were without leaves, and everything felt crisp and organized. The 20 miles from the airport to my childhood home would have been almost a day's ride on the bike. I was staring at everything. My mom was talking about the holiday plans. I'd slipped right back into a previous life. The bike might have been a dream. We were home before I would have had time to tie my bags to the rack. My sister and new baby niece were waiting at the house. I held the baby and thought about how life had moved on without me. I thought about my dad saying, "No one will change. Everyone will be the same when you get back." In this case, that was a lie. This baby was twice as big as when I saw her last. She had a different, fuller face. She had a personality. I had missed her becoming herself. I was home for 10 days. I saw old friends, and we went to Santa's, our favorite karaoke bar. We sang and drank cheap beer, and they asked me all the standard questions. Were you scared? How'd you charge your phone? I had canned answers at this point. I hated jokes like, "Hey, you're home. Did you quit? You can't just come back, cheater." I'd give a snarky response. "Did you just bike to Mexico City, or did I? I can do what I want. This is my trip." They'd laugh and say, "Good point." I had Christmas with my mom and siblings and the new baby. We ate honey-baked ham and watched old home videos. We laughed a lot and did next to nothing. My brother said, "How's the trip so far?" "Good and hard," I said. "Cool." And we didn't speak of it again. My mom and I didn't talk about anything too serious. We'd never talked about my sexuality in person, only over the phone, like twice, and by email, once. And she was so happy to see me, I knew she wouldn't taint it all with a confrontation. Neither would I. I wonder how many millions of relationships are alive because of this, avoiding conversations. I told her stories about Weston, about how much he loved weed, about getting lost in Mexico City and buying drugs. I told her these things to punish her for forcing me to invite someone else. I'm not sure why I felt the need to challenge my mother with these stories. She had been right. I was grateful she'd made me bring a friend, and I indeed loved Weston. Yet some spiteful teenager inside me wanted to poke at her. My mom would walk past me and put her hand on my shoulder and leave it a little too long. She would sit next to me at dinner and pat my knee and talk about her dogs or how the deer kept eating all her flowers. She kept touching me. She would ask me the same questions over and over with different words, as if the act of talking was the goal, not the exchange of information. And she would often launch into stories of walking across America, some I'd never heard. "You know why I want you to be so careful on those roads? I was walking in Texas, minding my own business, and your father way up ahead of me because he didn't like walking as slow as I needed to, and I got hit by a car going 60 miles an hour. This was before cell phones in the car, so I didn't know why they didn't see me. It was broad daylight. But they hit me square in my backpack, and I flew 40 feet in the air, and I landed on my backpack on the grass lawn of a mortuary. When I opened my eyes and realized I was alive and saw that mortuary, can you believe it? My pack saved my life. Well, the Lord saved my life, but used the backpack," she said with a laugh. "With you on a bike, I just worry so much. But I trust if the Lord could land me in a mortuary and wink at me like that with a little joke, he'll do the same for you." I was glad to have come home to see her, if for no other reason than to make her as happy as she was that Christmas. You know, there's a lot of scripture that talks about journeys, walking through the desert. Have you been reading the Bible I gave you? "Oh, yes, I have," I said, lying. "It means a lot to me that you gave me your Bible from the walk. Truly," I said, not lying. It hadn't dawned on me until that moment that I hadn't read the Bible once on my trip. I hadn't wanted to, but I had seen it in my bags. I had felt it on my bike, traveling with me, God with me. After the holiday and good lazy days with my mom, it was time to drive down and see my dad. He had been spending most of his time in Mississippi with his girlfriend. I had met her once before. She was from there and was quick-witted and crass in a classy way. She had a refinement about her, but would gossip with language like horse shit and a real backwoods racist asshole. I liked her right away. She gave my dad shit. She didn't worship him or coddle him. She just liked him, and I had never seen him that way with anyone. It was the flirtatiousness of 20-year-olds, strange and simultaneously inspiring. Ever since my dad divorced my stepmom back in 2006, his romantic life was a minefield in the family, especially for my sisters. He'd been married to my stepmom for 17 years. My half-sister came from that marriage, which I had thought would last. They seemed so in love. Then it ended. I was 23 years old. My sisters hated any new woman that came close. "This bitch can't just pretend like we're going to play house with her," my older sister would say. My brother and I didn't hate anyone. We just didn't care to invest ourselves. I was off in California, far away from Tennessee. I wanted my dad to be happy, but I also wanted him to be with someone that wouldn't take advantage of him or be terribly annoying. I had discovered my dad's humanity pretty early. He was never a god, not like my mom. He was my friend. When he called me to tell me he was divorcing my stepmom, I asked him why. He said he wasn't in love and he'd met someone else. I told him I was disappointed in him. He couldn't stay married. To me, it seemed like he married the way other people date. "Dad, you think love is the feeling of being in love, and when the feeling fades, you think it's because you made a mistake. So you leave. That's not love. That's not commitment," I said, with the confidence of never-married Christian arrogance. "Jed, I remember my dad was a real asshole. I remember he took me out in a boat when I was a teenager, and he had been real bad to my mother, and he said, You can hate me or not, but that's up to you. I'm the only father you'll ever have. You can hate me, but I'm just doing my best. He took me out in that boat and gave me permission to hate him. Took the rage right out of me. So, I'm sorry, but I'm tired of being sorry. I took all the blame with the divorce from your mother, and that's fine, but I can't take it anymore. I'm not sorry anymore. Life is really complicated. I hope you won't hate me. That took the rage right out of me. I felt his tiredness with himself. He was tired of guilt, tired of mistakes, tired of carrying it all. He wanted freedom. My sisters weren't ready to give it to him. I don't know if my brother was. I was. That conversation had a big impact on me, not just in humanizing my father, but in acquiescing to vice. I was in my 20s and fighting my vices, my sexuality, my manipulations, and here was my dad saying, I used to fight them. I quit that. Maybe you'd think it was inspiring to hear that kind of freedom. It was terrifying. He had wrecked several families and left daughters that wanted to strangle him. Ex-wives spoke of him like a hurricane they'd lived through. This was life? Quitting the fight and accepting yourself, flaws and all? I don't want to accept my flaws. I was melancholy about it all for a while. Then, like God hand-delivered me some hope into my hands, I was at a New Year's party a few months later, and a guy I didn't know gave a toast. He was drunk, but I think he said it right. Be ever at peace with your neighbors, ever at war with your vices, and let every year find you a better man. That's old Benji Franklin, he said, and cheersed his beer, splashing it high. In a moment, my thoughts were beyond the party, floating above us. Ever at war with your vices. It didn't say, let each year have you conquering a new vice. No, it wasn't about winning. It was about fighting, continuing the project of improvement. The intention and effort was what built character, not success. That changed a lot of things for me. I think it kept me from kissing boys for another 4 years, thinking that was a vice I had to fight forever. I think it also kept me from nihilistic meltdown. It was a double-edged sword. I never felt victimized by divorce. I never longed for some cohesive family unit. I can't explain why. I just didn't like the thick air that would form around my mom when she would complain about my dad. As for me, divorce was what normal families did. It's all I knew and all I remembered. Did my dad still love me? Yes. Did my mom still love me? Yes. Did my stepmom still love me? Sure. Then what's the big deal? But my sisters felt the divorces differently. They hated the blonde my dad had dated for a while. Then he met Kelly. She was smart and financially independent and had a good family and didn't give two shits about my dad's writing fame or money. But she didn't stand a chance. My sisters didn't like Kelly. Not necessarily because of anything she did. They just didn't want anything to do with another woman. Dad thinks we're just going to invite her in like she's part of the family, my older sister would say. I'm not doing this with every flavor of the month. In the past, my dad would have fought for my sisters. He would have said, Kelly is different. This one is real. He would have made time and tried to explain himself and sought out the girls over and over, bending over backward. He did try for about a year, but then something snapped. It dawned on him that he'd been apologizing his whole life. He'd been begging for forgiveness since the mid-80s. He was older now. He grew tired of the theatrics and decided to retreat. Nowadays, he spent most of his time at Kelly's house in Mississippi. My dad was in love with Kelly in a way I'd never seen before. There was a completeness, a brightness, an absence of guilt or escape. Seeing them together, it was strange. I wondered if they were each other's soulmate, and if that meant my mom and dad never were. And yet, here I am. It was all confusing. The politics of family, my dad staying at the farm, my sisters avoiding him, my brother avoiding conflict and not taking sides, the expectations of Christmas and family harmony, The things unsaid and the hurt buried. I didn't like it. It was like a squirming thing under the covers on a bed. It made me remember why I liked living in California, free from the odd feelings of family obligation and love. Somewhere inside my relationship to my family was the root of fear, fear of my sexuality, the root of my faith in God. My friends in California and the life I'd built out there were all on top of this small group of people that made me. I wondered for a moment if I had gotten on my bicycle to escape my family. Then I thought, no, I love these idiots. This mess is what made me. I just need to control my doses. It's easy to overdose and get sick. So it was just me, my dad, and Kelly down on his farm for a night. We ordered in Indian food, and Kelly was chatty. My dad didn't say much. He was watching us talk. I thought he would ask me all kinds of questions about the trip and slide into story mode about the first months of his great walk. But he didn't. The emotion of Christmas seemed to eat him alive. The decision not to beg my sisters to come down. I think he had asked my brother, but he hadn't come. The tension turned my dad into an introvert. I think he watched as Kelly and I laughed and hit it off and was glad, but also sad that it was only me. I think he was quiet because his thoughts were loud. At the end of dinner, Dad, in a peacocky way, said to me in front of Kelly, "Maybe we come visit you in Paraguay, or Peru, or Patagonia. Maybe we go on a trip and treat your tired legs to a nice hotel room. I've never been to South America." Kelly seemed thrilled. "Oh, yes. I've hardly ever been outside of Mississippi. I've barely ever seen a mountain. Let's go drink wine and see mountains." Her thick southern accent was like music in the room. No definitive plans were set, but the sweet intention was comforting. I loved the thought of adventuring with my dad, of witnessing something foreign to both of us, together, for the first time. At first arrival in Nashville, I thought my dad's advice was wrong. Home had changed, I had changed, and I was sad for it to flow by without me. I had a new niece. My sisters weren't talking to my dad's soon-to-be fiancé. Things felt like they'd been advancing quickly. But even a few days later, as Christmas wrapping paper was being thrown away and the post-holiday melancholy of monotony set in, I saw the truth of my father's words. The place went right back to normal, and that normalcy was what I was escaping. I had left my family for California, and now left California for the road. Not forever, but for this season. Only a year more. And it would be here when I got back. Perhaps tweaked and slightly changed, but not transformed. It would be the thing I stepped away from. It would be the routine I could return to. When the time came to go back, I emailed Weston. He was already at the beachside hotel in Nicaragua with friends. He said my bike had arrived. He also said he had tracked down some San Pedro cactus and would be making a potion on New Year's Eve. I didn't ask follow-up questions. I had seen and tasted home. It was still there, but I had dethroned it from my infatuated desire in Mexico. I could return to the bike, knowing that all the comforts of home would be waiting for me when I was ready. I was also reminded of what I was looking for, a shaking off of that film over my body I feel at home, of confusion, of self-loathing, of constriction. I had to peel it back and see myself clean of what I had been told. I boarded my plane for Nicaragua, more excited than I had expected. From Managua, the capital city, I bussed my way to the thatched roof beachside haven of Madeiras Village on the west coast. The stress of boxing up my bike and finding a service to mail it had paid off. There it was, the box beaten and crumpled, but all together. I felt affection for my bike, seeing it there waiting for me, like a dog. I pictured it wagging its tail to see me. A few of our friends from LA and New York were there. They had planned this group trip to Madeiras Village and talked about the fun drugs and parties we'd enjoy for New Year's. Weston quickly said yes and had already been down here for a week. I hadn't checked in on him much over the holiday. but I did miss him. Even 10 days apart now felt like the loss of a limb. Madeiras Village perched on a dusty cliff overlooking the Pacific coast of Nicaragua. The trees were crispy, and the dust from the dirt road kicked up into the air, coating every low leaf. It was the dry season. The world was browned, the air hot, the ocean cool and inviting. I walked up the property looking for friends, passing by a few cabins and a main house, and asked an overly tan man in short board shorts and Ray-Bans if he knew Weston. The guy was obviously American. Oh yeah, he's making some magic potion up behind the last cabins. Just keep walking up the hill. I found him in the woods, stirring a cauldron over a wood fire with people I didn't know. He was shirtless, shoeless, with tattered khaki shorts, and a big stick stirring the brown milky substance in the pot. The strangers were sun crispy and barefoot too, staring intently into the mixture. "Jed!" Weston exclaimed, as happy to see me as I was to see him. "Come, come. I got us some San Pedro cactus, and I'm making a potion. I have to boil it for 12 hours, then drain it with this cheesecloth. We're on hour 2.
"You have to stir for 10 more hours?" I asked.
"Yeah, or it will burn."
"What does San Pedro do to you?"
I felt like a dad asking about his son's new toy. "It's one of 3 cactuses with mescaline," Weston explained. "In the right doses, it makes you euphoric, gives you visions, exposes the parts of the brain that can only be reached by this. It's actually one of the safest natural ways to experience an altered spiritual state. Not like Datura or Angel's Trumpet, which can kill you. You just don't want to drink a lot of this because it tastes like worm snot."
"It's nasty? Yikes."
"Well, yeah, but it's magic that has to be respected. It's called the grandfather in shaman lore. He is wise and guides you gently with love, but doesn't that make you ask questions? About God or the universe? Why would the universe make parts of our brains, parts of us, only accessible by these plants he placed around us in nature? Seems to me like we're supposed to access truth through them. Nature is reaching out to teach us right now, show us things, because our society is killing nature. Mescaline is one of those doors the universe wants us to walk through. And it's a bitch to prepare, right? But I think it's worth it."
"Wow, sounds amazing," I said, no longer patronizing, actually interested.
"Yeah, but it's better to be sober and have an empty stomach for 6 to 12 hours before, or you'll vomit, so I'm starving. But it's worth it. Makes it last longer. I've got to stir for a few more hours. Go have a look around this place. It's beautiful. Go stake a hammock spot. Our homies are down at the beach."
"How was your Oaxacan mushroom thing?" I asked.
"Incredible. This house in the mountains with people from all over, Germans, Canadians. It wasn't one of those Mickey Mouse hostels for tourists. It's the real people. We did a full moon hike, tripping, and I went off by myself and got lost in the woods, and I was barefoot, and I must have been out there for 6 hours, and the sun came up, and it was amazing. You wouldn't have liked the place, though. It was all psychedelics and crystals." I laughed. "You know me so well." I left Weston to his potion and explored the little coastal resort. Cabins made of bamboo and palapa roofs. A main open-air lounge attached to a communal kitchen. Hammocks everywhere. Weston and his salty buddies had their magic juice, and the sun got low and the howler monkeys started screaming, and I was back. Weston stayed high most of the time at Madeiras Village, smiling and lying in a hammock, or mixing potions and planting the sliced tops of his San Pedro cactuses around the property. He said he didn't want to kill the cactuses, just borrow them. He filled me in on his travels, what it was like to bus across Guatemala and El Salvador, lugging his bicycle and his dirty panniers. He had spent Christmas on a beach in El Salvador and visited Lake Atitlan in the Guatemalan highlands. "So many rich California hippies renting houses," he said. "It was too expensive for me." I thought I would be sad hearing him describe these places I had missed, but I wasn't. If anything, I was sad I couldn't brag about having been there. We had 6 days on the coast in Nicaragua to party with our friends, tell stories, and work on our sunburns. January 1st, 2014 arrived with a bonfire on the beach. I felt wild. This was the year I would finish my trip, and I was already excited for it to be over. I'd learned what life on a bicycle was like. I'd escaped the office life and learned some shit. In many ways, I'd exchanged an old routine for a new one. No mind-reshaping epiphany had come, and I didn't feel like it was on its way. I hadn't read my Bible once on the trip. I hadn't kissed anyone. I hadn't tried any crazy drugs. I was excited to see Panama, Colombia, Peru, Patagonia. I was. But the damn bike. I wanted to take more buses, to skip the boring parts, but I also didn't want to. I felt the duty of the promise I made to myself and the expectations of all my friends watching. This trip had become my job. Hourly, my thoughts transitioned from dread to duty to excitement to anxious in a cycle. By then, Weston had developed a crush on a Swedish girl, and he wanted to follow her to a surf spot on the coast of Costa Rica. He needed sex, he said. I said that was fine. I'd meet him down in Costa Rica. I was rejuvenated from having spent 10 days at home. If Weston needed more time to enjoy the beach, to make his potion, to have some sex, I was fine with that. He would ride with her in a surf van. I would bike alone down the rest of Nicaragua and into Costa Rica. It would be my first time biking alone. On January 5th, I packed up my bike. The task had become a ritual, robotic and easy. Tie my backpack onto the back, tuck my sleeping bag next to it, resting them both on the rack between the panniers, tie my boots by their shoelaces to my backpack, take my rope, which by now was worn and fraying, and tie it back and forth across my things to secure them, fill my water bottles. Done. I said goodbye to the Nicaraguan beach, to Weston and our sunburned friends, and headed south. Biking to the Costa Rican border over a few days, I stayed at tiny hotels for cheap. I didn't talk to anyone except as a means to an end. I listened to Radiolab episodes in my headphones and biked. I passed farms, brown in the dry season. I rode around goats and emaciated horses in the road. I went through towns that looked much like the ones I'd seen in Mexico. At the border check, tourists swarmed off buses to get their passports stamped. I waited in line, and when I got to the front, the border agent asked for proof of a departing flight. "A departing flight from Costa Rica? I don't have one," I said. "Costa Rica requires that you have proof of a temporary stay. You will not be admitted without proof. You need proof of a purchased flight out," the border agent said, annoyed that I hadn't done my research. "Well, I don't have that because I'm riding my bicycle. I'm going to Patagonia." "Patagonia? What is that?" "Yes, the bottom of Chile." "You're riding a bicycle to Chile? Where is this bicycle?" I pointed through the glass window to the bike outside, leaning on a railing. My pointing and the agent's craning his neck caused the 20 or so people in line behind me to turn around and see what we were looking at. A crusty, dusty bike piled with bags. "Look, I have passport stamps in Mexico and Nicaragua. Coming in and out, see, temporary," I said, flipping through my passport in his direction. "I am going to leave Costa Rica in about 3 weeks, I promise." He pulled his lips into his teeth while he scrutinized my passport. Then he peered out at my bike again. "Patagonia," he said to himself, as he loudly stamped my passport and handed it back. Only then did he offer a flat smile, proud of himself for letting me into his country. Costa Rica was quickly greener and the hills steeper than Nicaragua. The pavement was fresh and the country felt different, richer. I enjoyed the pace of being alone, stopping at a whim, taking an impromptu nap under a tree. I would have been frightened to cycle alone a few months ago, but this was my new life, and life on the road was my new normal. Dry season was in full effect, even in the greenness of Costa Rica, and it was very hot. Sweat built up in my helmet and poured down my face and neck and back. By my fourth day alone, my bike shorts had turned into a science experiment of filth. I made it to the coastal town of Tamarindo, where Wesson and I had decided to meet up. We had picked a decent-looking hostel online, and I hoped I'd find him lounging in a hammock when I pulled in. Close, he was playing cards and smoking cigarettes with some overly tan white boys with beach-knotted hair. I walked in with my bike and stood there with a big grin, excited for him to notice me. Our little separations were nice. We worked better in doses. He looked up from his cards to take a drag of a cigarette, saw me, threw his cards down, leaped up, and waltzed over. "He biked alone," he said for everyone's benefit, "cast away the sequel," and grabbed me in a hug. "How was the Swedish girl?" I asked immediately. Oh, he said, smiling wildly. "She drained me right up. She's incredible. I am empty, if you know what I mean. Empty." "Dude, you're gonna get someone pregnant," I said, thumping him on the back and laughing. "I hope so," he said. Tamarindo is a tourist trap of themed bars with names like Dragonfly and Sharky's Sports Bar with $15 Mai Tais and beaches with jet ski rentals and horrible souvenirs. We stayed a few days at a touristy hostel for $18 a night, the most expensive we'd seen yet. "How are you on money?" I asked Weston while we were lying in hammocks, waiting out the midday heat. "I mean, I have none," he said with a chuckle. "Dude, we have another year of this," I said. "I know, but I'll be okay. I'm getting a little money from my mom soon, and I don't need much. This is an experiment. Do we need money, really?" "This hostel is like $20 a night." "Yeah, I'll need to leave soon. It's wasted money. I bet I can find a girl on the beach or on Tinder and stay for free for a few nights," he said, grinning. His travel plan didn't include me and didn't appeal to me anyway, so I tried to explain my concerns without starting a fight. "I know. You have money. I don't. We'll be okay," he said. "Remember, we can split up and hang during the days. That's fine." I didn't like this idea, but I didn't know what options we had. You know someone best by traveling with them. When someone is outside their comfort zone, when they are hungry or exhausted, and when money is involved, you see the sides of them that are often covered up in social niceties. Weston and I were slamming all of that together, and it wasn't easy. Tamarindo was full of Israelis, Australians, and Americans, all of them loud. The Costa Rican locals we saw on the streets, the vendors and staff, seemed vacant, robotically offering us boat tours, zipline excursions, cocaine. Exactly what I didn't want for this trip. And Weston didn't want to spend another dollar, so after a few days, we packed up. The baked-out blonde who ran the front desk of the hostel told us that the east coast of Costa Rica was a real gem. It was Caribbean, with a totally different feel, way fewer tourists, and beautiful. I studied the map and saw that we could cross the country past Lake Arenal and the volcano and drop down onto the Caribbean side. It would take only 5 days. To get there, Weston and I rode uphill for 2 days. Mile by mile, the dry season gave way to higher altitudes and wetter land. The golden grass turned to green ferns and tangled forest. When we reached the lake, it was foggy and dramatic and dark blue. We dropped our bikes, ran to the shore, and dove in. The winding road around the lake was littered with mansions and cabins ripe for Airbnb, with sweeping views, wildflowers, and waterfalls. Around one corner, we came upon a stopped car in the middle of the road, and a woman with her flashers on. She was out of the car and seemed to be covered in cats. No, not cats, dogs, jumping on her. As we approached, the dogs looked very strange, like monkeys. Wait, were they monkeys? What the hell? The woman had crackers in her hands, and she was laughing as they crawled on her legs. She was talking to them in German. Weston and I parked our bikes behind her car and called to her. "What the hell are those things?" I said. "They are coatis. They want my crackers," she said with a cackle and a thick German accent. She was dropping crackers at her feet, where about 20 of the creatures were frantically eating them. They looked like a cross of a monkey, a dog, a raccoon, and a lemur. They walked on all fours but could stand on their hind legs and had useful little hands. Their snouts were very long, cartoonishly long. They were orangish-brown, and their tails had rings like a raccoon. They were taller and bigger than raccoons, though, about the size of a cocker spaniel. I got closer. I wanted to touch one. I wanted to feel its fur. I wanted it to wrap its tail around my neck and be my sidekick. Somehow,